From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For months now, we've heard the rationale for war with Iraq, the cry for regime change, the threat of weapons of mass destruction. But in the long build-up to taking on Baghdad, there's been almost no talk about how much this war with Iraq will cost, who's going to pay, and how. This hour, On Point, calculating the cost of war, its impact on the U.S. economy, and on you. But first tonight, Congress weighs in on 9/11, a joint report released by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees today, lays out intelligence blunders that may have led to the September 11th attacks. Earlier, I spoke with James Risen, reporter for the New York Times, and asked him whether the congressional report is likely to have real consequences or simply be heavyweight grandstanding.
I think it's probably going to have more weight than most reports and independent commissions do, because September 11th was such a huge event, and this is the first official inquiry into that event that's been completed. And so I think it does have a certain amount of weight. Of course, you've got another one coming down the road very soon, the independent commission.
Headed by Henry Kissinger and George Mitchell.
Right. So it's hard to tell, you know, whether one will overshadow the other, but I think they both will have a certain amount of weight. I think this one especially because, you know, it's Congress has a lot of power to, legislate, obviously. So.
But this is Congress's big shot. Who does the Joint Congressional Committee that spent all this time and all these man and woman hours hold responsible for 9/11? Is there blame here? Who does the report should say, who should be held responsible?
Well, that's one of the disputes that came out today. Was Senator Richard Shelby issued a separate report because he said he was disappointed that the committee didn't hold anyone personally accountable.
And this is the ranking Senate Republican on the joint panel.
Right. And he issued a separate minority report today in which he did name some names of key senior government officials who he thinks should have done a better job prior to 9/11.
Most particularly George Tenet, head of the CIA.
Yes. Yes, and also Air Force General who runs the NSA, Michael Hayden.
This is National Security Agency, the big intelligence and data gathering outfit.
Right, and then he also identified Louis Freeh, the former FBI director.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't name Robert Mueller at the FBI because he was only on the job for a week prior to 9/11.
Will heads roll as a result of this congressional inquiry?
Well, the full committee has called for inspectors general at various agencies to take the findings of fact, which they have released, and recommend actions at their agencies. Although it doesn't identify individuals involved in each incident, are saying that they are asking the IGs at the different agencies to investigate the handling of those incidents.
So the big, powerful congressional panel comes up with no names, no one to blame, no one to hold responsible, and asks the inspectors general, I guess, of the CIA and FBI to go after their own chieftains?
That's certainly the way Mr. Shelby described the report. Senator Graham and others who were on the committee feel that their job was not to point fingers and that they were trying to be more forward-leaning and offer reforms, systemic reforms, rather than point fingers. And Senator Graham said today he thought that pointing fingers would just make the intelligence community more risk-averse than it already is.
Perhaps the biggest recommended reform is the recommendation of the creation of a cabinet-level intelligence czar.
Right.
How is that visualized? What would the responsibilities of this intelligence super cabinet member be?
Well, it's a little unclear. It would apparently have broad budget authority, all of the various intelligence agencies. The CIA director would, instead of being in charge of both the CIA and the entire intelligence community, would only be in charge of the CIA. And this new director of national intelligence would coordinate activities throughout all the various agencies. That would lead to conflict with the Secretary of Defense because about 80% of the intelligence community is inside the Pentagon. And so one of the problems the CIA director has always had is he has nominal authority over all the intelligence community, but the budget authority for most of it lies with the Secretary of Defense. And so that issue of how this new director of national intelligence would interact with the Secretary of Defense is unclear, at least in my mind.
Is this an idea that is likely to be taken up seriously, or is it a kind of grand dead letter recommendation?
I think it'll get some serious consideration. I think Senator Graham said today he was asked that same question, and he said, there's one important number that makes these recommendations to be taken more seriously than in the past, and he said, and that's 3,025, number of people killed on September 11th.
Is that a number, in your experience, James Risen, that's really and truly still resonating around Washington, or is that a kind of formulaic nod of the head to those who died?
I think it's still taken seriously. I think it doesn't get any more serious than that.
Well, it doesn't, in fact, but one wonders what the ramifications are. Will these reforms really come to pass, or is this just a day's news story and back we go to business as usual?
Who knows exactly, but I think that you can see with the Homeland Security debate was that ideas that previously didn't seem to be going anywhere, the creation of a whole new department, suddenly have been taken seriously. You know, for whatever reason, political reasons that led to the Homeland Security Department, an idea that never would have gone anywhere prior to September 11th actually did happen. And Senator Graham, I think, and some others have pointed out that this could be the flip side of the Homeland Security debate, the foreign intelligence debate.
James Risen, finally, how is it expected that the recommendations, the report of the Joint Congressional Committee, will interact with the eventual report by the independent 9/11 panel headed by Henry Kissinger and George Mitchell? Does one trump the other? Do we have to wait for the Kissinger-Mitchell report in order for these recommendations to be acted on? Are we in a holding position until the next shoe drops?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure how Congress will move on this. Senator Graham said today he doesn't think they can wait. But it's unclear whether he will take the lead in introducing legislation immediately on this or not. You know, the Kissinger Commission hasn't even started yet, and it would take another year or more for them to complete their work. So I doubt that they would want to wait for that report to introduce legislation on this.
James Risen, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
James Risen is a reporter with the New York Times. He spoke with us from Washington. America is getting used to sitting on the brink of war with Iraq, but one day soon, the country may wake to learn the war of words is over and the hot war has begun. If and when it comes, it's going to be expensive. But how expensive? And who's going to pay? The White House has presented its reasons for war. It hasn't said much about a price tag. But the time to talk about war and the cost of a new generation of fighting and security threats is now, say our guests tonight. The U.S. will be looking at a war bill in the many billions and conceivably trillions of dollars. Wars have many consequences. Some go right to the bottom line. Some are indirect but expensive, too. How much are you willing to pay for war with Iraq? Are you ready for some belt tightening on the home front to pay for bombing runs over Baghdad? And in an era of ever greater security demands, should Americans be asked now to cut back on social services for intelligence and guns? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from New Haven, Connecticut is William Nordhaus, Sterling Professor of Economics at Yale University and author of War with Iraq, Costs, Consequences, and Alternatives, a study published by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Good evening and welcome, Professor William Nordhaus.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. We're also joined tonight from New York by Robert Hormats, Vice Chairman of Goldman Sachs International. He served on the National Security Council and in the State Department in the Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Reagan administrations. Good evening and welcome, Robert Hormats.
Good evening. Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. William Nordhaus, lead us in here, if you would. You've pointed out the Bush White House has put out no official estimate of what this war with Iraq will cost. You spent a good deal of time thinking about it and poking at what's out there, what we can know, what we can't know. What are you coming away with? And perhaps the way to begin here is, how does an economics professor begin to think about the costs of a war like this one?
Yeah. Well, basically, you start with looking at the military costs of a war like this, and those are actually showing up in the budget numbers, so those are pretty straightforward. And to do that, basically, military analysts look at past wars or look at what the costs would be of the fuel and the armaments and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And in the war, if we were to go to war with Iraq, the numbers there range from a low of around $50 billion to a high in a protracted war of maybe $140 billion.
A protracted war meaning?
Protracted war might be one where just things become more difficult. It might be urban warfare. There might be all kinds of complications and might drag on. Instead of being over in in a week or 10 days or 2 weeks might drag on for a month or two.
That's protracted. I mean, Americans have experience of protracted war that's in the many years.
Yeah, but we're talking about war between countries or military forces that are really unequal in terms of their capabilities. And again, these are very hard things to to predict. But if you're talking to military specialists in the United States, these are the kind of range of reasonable possibilities that people think.
So that's $50 billion in the quick, efficient, and unentangled war, and
right.
in a, what you call a protracted conflict. And here we're talking about still a matter of months. $120 billion in direct military costs.
Yeah, $140 billion. Then I guess one of the things that's a little surprising to me as I got into this was that when you look at the costs, it's actually the non-military costs that are likely to be the more significant ones.
What might those be?
And those basically come in three categories. Mm-hmm. One is the post-war, just cleaning up the mess costs, and those would be occupation costs, peacekeeping, reconstruction, humanitarian assistance, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And those actually we don't there are basically no numbers coming out of Washington on those. Those basically have to patch together from all kinds of sources all around the world. Then that's just sort of adding up the numbers. The other two are more really directly economic ones. And the first has to do with the impact on oil markets. And here I think the possible worry would be that for any of a number of reasons, you'd see some shortages and a spike in oil prices with prices going up to, you know, doubling or even tripling over the period right during and after the war. And that is very, very costly for the country. And then the final thing that you might worry about is that a war could trigger a recession as companies and consumers begin to tighten their belt and become a little anxious and stop spending. So those are basically the three big ones.
Mm-hmm. And if those get bundled in here with the cost of war, then what kind of range of cost are we looking at? Rebuilding, potential oil market instability, and possibly recession?
Well, if you take the two extremes that I looked at, one is the short and favorable low cost, and the other is protracted unfavorable high cost, the range was at the low end, about $100 billion, and we're talking over the next decade or so, and at the high end, just shy of $2 trillion.
And that's including the military direct costs and the secondary costs?
Yes. The military costs actually, particularly in the high cost, are a relatively small fraction of the total. The really big numbers come from the indirect, the occupation, the oil markets, and the recession possibilities.
We're going to come back from a break and talk about the meaning for the American economy of $100 billion or $2 trillion. It's hard to juggle these figures in our mind. But Robert Hormetz, I want to just turn to you quickly, if I may, before the break. You've been writing that we should stand up and take into account the costs of security in a more dangerous world now, even before this war, even before we get further into the war on terror, that we don't want to repeat a kind of Vietnam era of pretending the costs aren't there and paying for it later in inflation and economic price.
That's exactly right. I think we have to accept the fact that this war could be a very expensive war, as Bill has very effectively pointed out. But if you look at the cost of security in terms of the war itself, the aftermath of the war, the occupation, the peacekeeping, the reconstruction, then you add to that increasing costs for homeland defense, some of which are borne by the federal government, some of which are borne by state and local governments. Then you add the fact that we have had an increase in domestic spending over the last year, year and a half, which is very different from past wartime scenarios, say World War II or the Korean War. During World War II, President Roosevelt consciously cut back on domestic programs, including some New Deal programs that he himself had initiated, and raised taxes. And President Truman during the Korean War did the same thing.
Robert Hormetz, we'll come
back. With bipartisan support from the Congress.
We'll come back and look at that in more detail. We're talking tonight about the cost of war with Iraq. What's it going to be? And the greater cost of a new age of heightened security. If you're ready for war, are you ready to pay for war? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the cost of war with Iraq and maybe the greater cost of a new age of heightened security. What is this war worth to you? What are the trade-offs here? What should we be ready to give up to finance the war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you believe in your heart of hearts? Are you ready to feel the price? Do you expect this war to be painless? Do you think that you, in your life, are going to feel the cost of war on Iraq? My guests tonight are William Nordhaus. He's Sterling Professor of Economics at Yale University and author of a new study out just last month, War with Iraq, Costs, Consequences, and Alternatives. And from New York, Robert Hormats, Vice Chairman at Goldman Sachs. He was author of The Cost of Fighting, a recent op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. He's a former member of the National Security Council. You can join us as well. William Nordhaus, put into perspective the numbers you were giving us before the break. $100 billion at the quick, no fumbles, no hassles side of the equation. $2 trillion if it gets protracted, long, difficult, and is compounded by oil market problems, long-term rebuilding costs, and maybe even recession. We're told $100 billion, the U.S. economy can swallow it up like it's nothing. Is that true? And if it goes to $2 trillion, what are the consequences of that?
Yeah. There are a couple of ways of thinking of it. One way is in terms of our average household. $100 billion is about $1,000 a household. So if you think of your family budget, it's taking a whack of about $1,000 out of that. At the high end, the numbers are really pretty scary. The higher number is close to $20,000 per household over the next decade. So you can see that's putting it down in our own family terms. Another way to think of it is if we think back to the kind of recessions we've had, the recession of 1991 or the recession of 2001, these are actually the equivalent of a really mild recession and unemployment in the low case, or a really bad one in the case of the high cost. So these are the high case, it's really a pretty serious numbers for an average American household.
And how does that kind of a load get paid typically in the American system?
Yeah.
Is there a war surcharge? Are we all going to see this touted straight onto our income taxes? Is it buried in debt and paid off over many decades? Who pays and how?
Yeah. Well, in the case of – there are really a couple of things. In case of the budget costs, which are likely to be – who knows, $100 billion, maybe up to $500 billion over the next decade, it's going to come from a variety of sources. But I think my own view is that it's likely to come out of less in the way of government services. The other ones, I think in case of oil markets, that's a really simple one. It basically means that we're going to be paying $20, $50 a gallon more at the pump.
Are you saying 20 cents, 50 cents a gallon
20
more?
20 cents, 50 mm-hmm. cents, mm-hmm. or a dollar a gallon more at the pump for our gasoline, or in case of your Boston Providence listeners, it's their winter heating oil. So that's the way it's paid there. And then in terms of recession, it means people lose jobs and they lose their income as they get thrown out of work or have shorter hours. So it's actually it's not a single way. It kind of hits you. It's kind of death by a thousand cuts. It hits you from a lot of different ways.
And Robert Hormats, you're saying that the time to step up and confront these greater expenses coming in the age of terror and the age of untrammeled or uncontrolled threats of weapons of mass destruction, that we should step up and take that hit now, that we should begin cutting social programs, as I read you, so that we don't end up in a kind of downward economic spiral a few years down the road. Why do you say that?
Well, I'm saying that we need to have a debate on this issue, because if we're going to go to war with Iraq, we need to go in with our eyes open. We need a candid debate. How are we going to pay for it? Are we, as a country, willing to pay for it in terms of higher taxes? Or if we don't want higher taxes, are we willing to sacrifice some domestic programs, particularly domestic programs that cost a great deal of money? There's not a lot of flexibility in the budget, but there is some room for discretionary spending cuts. But if we don't go into it now, we're going to build up very big budget deficits, just the way we did in the Vietnam period, where we thought we could have guns and butter. And we're now adding money for the military. That could increase. We're adding costs for Homeland Defense. We're adding other kinds of domestic spending. We just passed a big farm bill earlier this year. And we also have tax cuts that have been enacted last year that are going to begin to kick in over the next several years. So we're trying to do everything. We're trying to have more security. We're trying to have more domestic programs and lower taxes. Something has to give. And my argument is we ought to debate this now before we build up massive budget deficits, before we get into a Vietnam situation where the government crowded out the private sector, where you had big deficits, high rates of inflation, and particularly high interest rates. And if you look at this economy, one of the things that sustained this economy is the housing market. If you start getting a situation where the government's borrowing a lot of money, where the economy starts growing again, that means that the private sector is borrowing a lot of money, you're going to squeeze out a lot of potential private sector investors and push up interest rates for mortgages. Mm. That would be one area in which this manifests itself. So a candid debate now is better than waiting too long till we get into a difficult situation.
Robert Hormats, reading just between the lines of what you've written on this, I don't see political opposition necessarily to this war on your part, but you're saying if we're going to do it, and maybe we should, let's figure out how we're going to pay for it. Am I right about that?
That's exactly right. I think that this country, if we believe that we need to deal with the Iraqis through military action, and if we believe, as I believe, that we need to increase money for homeland defense to deal with the kinds of problems that we've seen on September 11 and we could see again.
And I sense that you favor both of these moves.
Well, I'm not against them. In fact, I do think we probably have to go to war to get Saddam Hussein and to disarm him. And I do think we certainly need more homeland defense. But we ought to be very candid. Roosevelt asked for sacrifice among Americans to fight the war. This was the Second World War, which is more expensive than the wars we're talking about. But nonetheless,
sacrifice on
one
what
has
scale?
To be candid.
Well, on what scale?
Well, I think, as Bill's pointed out, the numbers in World War II were considerably greater than are likely in this environment. But we have to figure out what those numbers are. We don't know at this point. I mean, there is a level of uncertainty anytime you go into a war, what the costs will be. But we have to be prepared for an expensive war because we know in wars that the unexpected can occur.
And you're the finance guy. As I read you casting your eye across the plane of American government spending, it seems to be falling on social spending as the place that we would or will or should rein in order to pay for new security requirements to pay for war. Do I read that correctly?
Well, my argument would be that something has to give. We're increasing defense spending. We're increasing spending for homeland defense. We have a choice. We can cut back on social programs, or we can raise taxes or at least not implement some of the tax cuts that were legislated last year. But you can't do everything without a very large increase in the budget deficit. Now, if we want to do that, if we want to have a big increase in the budget deficit, we run the risk of higher interest rates, which costs everyone a fair amount, particularly if you want to finance a mortgage, but could ultimately slow the economy down. And then we're also sort of pushing off the financial burden on our children and grandchildren who have to finance these big budget deficits in future years. So one way or another, we have to look at the options. What is it going to cost and how are we going to pay for it? Are we going to pay for it in cutting social programs, raising taxes, postponing certain tax cuts, or building up a very big budget deficit, which means higher interest rates in the out years for a lot of people? There is a cost here. There is a price.
No free
lunch. We can't deny the price.
William Nordhaus, give us another perspective on this. We've had Nicholas Lemon from The New Yorker on. He's written about the jaunty attitude in Washington toward the war. And we've had administration representatives or people close to the administration essentially shrugging off the cost of this war and saying, you know, it may even be a net positive. There'll be armaments that will be manufactured in the United States. It may be a stimulus. It may even be a shot in the arm for the U.S. economy. How do you read that?
Well, I think on the whole, I'm lined myself up with Bob Hormats. I think he's really pointed out the fact that we're trying to eat our cake and have it too, in terms of cutting taxes, building up our military, going to war, and not really tackling any of our budget issues. So I think we really need to face with the fact that we can't do all these things at once.
But you don't see it as a shot in the arm. You don't see war as just what the doctor ordered to kickstart the economy,
you know,
never
that,
mind the blood.
Yeah, that's the way wars used to be in the old days when they were big wars, and they led to large expenditures and for military and large growth in military personnel. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at the way wars have been fought over the last decade, that's just not the way it works. You don't see the huge expansions in defense spending anymore. You see, what you've seen over the last year, which has actually been a pretty big buildup, is about what you saw during the Persian Gulf War in 1991, which is about 0.3% of total income or output. And this compares with numbers like 10% back in the Korean War or even before the first shot was fired in World War II. So my own sense is actually in terms of the effect on the economy, that the big effect is going to be the psychological reaction when the bullets start flying, and how consumers are going to react. Are they going to get frightened? Are they going to start get worried and tighten their belts? Are businesses going to decide it's not a time to lay some more cable? Are mm-hmm. consumers going to stop thinking about their renovations of their new houses
and hunker down?
And if you actually look at the last time this happened in 1990, the war actually it was actually the first time in recent history, really in all of American history, that you had a war and the economy went south rather than north. That's to say, it turned sour rather than expansionary.
And of course, that time the Bush Senior went out on operation, what they call Operation Tin Cup, got allies to pretty much pay for the Persian Gulf War. It only cost Americans about $7 billion, really nothing compared to what we're looking at this time.
Right, but the scale of the buildup in terms of the overall economy is, yeah, I mean, even if we're talking about $50 billion or up to $100 billion, that it's much, much smaller than it was in earlier years, and it's likely to be overwhelmed by the psychological reactions of consumers and businesses.
Not a stimulus plan. William Nordhaus, Robert Hormat, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, guys. I got a couple of questions. First of all, as a result of the Republican tax cuts that were passed last year, I'm wondering what the deficit for this year is and what the national debt is currently. And then, of course, if this war is going to cost $100 or $200 billion, what the national debt and deficit impact will be then. And then I want to know from the economists, you know, at what point does the deficit become so big and the national debt become so big that, you know, it can lead us down that inflationary path to basically economic ruin. That's basically what I would like to know.
We'll put it right to them, John. Thank you for your call. William Nordhaus, I guess let me turn to you first on this deficit front. We're hearing people who would have expected to be deficit hawk Republicans now saying we've got economic problems and deficits are all right in a period like this. And I wonder if this potential cost of war is just getting rolled into that bundle. How big is the deficit getting? Is it a problem?
Yeah. Well, what we've seen over the last 2 years is that the federal budget has gone from surplus to deficit. It's probably going to be in the $200 billion range this year. My own view, Bob Hormat said a little earlier, he referred to the Vietnam period. Another period which is very similar is the early 1980s, when we had another military buildup, another big tax cut, and basically a kind of carefree attitude toward the deficit, although it came back to haunt us. I just think that what's happening is that many of the people, particularly in the administration, just want to ignore the deficit, because if you actually want to face up to it, you have to realize that something's got to give, and it could well be this big tax cut that's waiting in the wings for the later part of the decade.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And this is WBUR. You're listening to On Point with Tom Ashbrook, one of the many programs that your pledges pay for. Our year-end fundraiser is coming to a close very, very quickly. It's over in less than a half an hour.
We're now minutes away from the fundraiser, not that we're giddy about it or anything. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call if you haven't yet had a chance to make a contribution yet during this fundraiser. We could use your help. We have $425,000 contributed so far, which is just remarkable. Thank you very, very much.
It's
if
amazing.
You've contributed part of that, we really appreciate that. But if you haven't had a chance now, just minutes, about a half an hour left to go, so give us a call. The last push is on here at 1-800-909-9287. 877-381-3787.
We're talking about some pretty serious business here, as you just heard this incredible conversation on Point, which we didn't want to interrupt, by the way. We just let the last half hour go for you because and for us, because it's fascinating and it's important. And now we just want to take a second to say, to remind you that On Point is a program born of necessity. We needed it because of all the news in the last year and a half after the September 11th attacks, and we just needed to have round-the-clock news coverage, so we created On Point, and it stayed because it's so good. Here and Now was also a program born of a necessity when Christian Science Monitor Radio stopped doing their programming. Who knows what the necessity is going to be in the year ahead? 1-800-909-9287.
You give us the resources to cover the necessities, though, and that's what your money is going toward. Here and Now, On Point, The Connection, All Things Considered, Marketplace, Morning Edition, of course, and all the great programs you enjoy on the weekend. Half the money for them comes from contributions from listeners. So if you haven't made one yet this year, or you can make an additional contribution for the year, this would be the time to do it, because there's only a half an hour left in this year-end fundraiser. The number to call is 1-800-909-9287.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by 10,000 Villages in Brookline and Cambridge, a nonprofit store featuring fairly traded holiday gifts from ornaments to housewares, online at 10,000villages.org. And Sophos Antivirus, presenting a complimentary live online seminar on network antivirus protection, December 17th at 1 p.m. Registration details available at sophos.com. And Blue Man Group at the Charles Playhouse, offering gift certificates to the show as a unique holiday gift for all ages, available online at blueman.com or 1-800-BLUE-MAN. And we know how it is this time of year. The holidays are over for some people, and the holidays are bearing down on us for others. Either way, it's just such a busy time of year. If you have a to-do list, and who doesn't? Here's mine here. I have things on my to-do list from 1975. I never get to them. They keep getting moved down.
Whoa.
When, well, you know, you have to prioritize.
Sure.
But try to move us up to the top of the list in the next few minutes. 1-800-909-9287, because you're going to feel so much better to cross it off the list and get going with everything else that lies ahead at this busy time.
Even better, you know, it's only going to take 2 or 3 minutes on the website or the telephone. So rather than even take the time to put it on the list, just pick up the phone instead. You'll be done, and you really feel that sense of accomplishment. 1-800-909-9287 or WBUR.org. You know, you can look at these fleece jackets that we've been talking about during the fundraiser, the
very
different
attractive
colors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like the On Point jacket. Or the WBUR jacket or the Here and Now jacket, Robin Young Show.
On Point is blue, I think.
I think it mm-hmm. is, but you can confirm that at the website, WBUR.org. You can make your pledge there as well. And if you make a $365 contribution right now, a dollar a day for a year of great radio and vital listening, then we'll thank you by sending you one of these fleece jackets. Last chance to do it, though, because this is the tail end of this year-end fundraiser. So on the web, WBUR.org. On the phone, 1-800-909-9287.
WBUR supporters also include Frugal Fanny's Fashion Warehouse, proud sponsor of WBUR's A Christmas Carol to benefit Rosie's Place, this Saturday at 7 p.m. Tickets are available through rosies.org. And the Elliott Hotel in Clio, featuring holiday gift packages with luxury suite accommodations, dinner for two at Clio, and boutique gift certificates. Details at elliotthotel.com. And Dana-Farber Partners Cancer Care, a collaboration among Mass General Hospital, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Brigham and Women's Hospital, working together to fight adult cancer. Cancercare.harvard.edu. Of course, you know, you can call and be a supporter of WBUR at any time, right, Jay? If they call tomorrow,
sure.
We're not going to say,
we'd never turn them away.
Right. But there are other incentives to call by 8 o'clock tonight. One of them has been...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the cost of war with Iraq. What's this war worth to you? Is the Bush administration being sufficiently upfront about the cost of war with Iraq? And if we're in a new age of war and terror, do we have to downsize our national dreams to pay for it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are William Nordhaus, professor of economics at Yale University, and Robert Hormats, vice chairman of Goldman Sachs, former member of the National Security Council. You can join us as well. Eric is on the line. Welcome, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, actually, I had a quick comment and then a question. My comment was I thought that looking at the possible stimulative effect of the war on GDP might be a little potentially misleading if these additional bombs and warships and whatnot are created or built for this. That may add nominally to GDP, but it seems like it's taking away resources from whether it's hospitals or cars or other things.
Yeah, and Bill Nordhaus, our economist tonight, is saying don't look for a big stimulative bump there.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, right. And then the question that I wasn't sure from the report was whether or not any of the human costs were being included in this. I mean, with the World Trade Center, various people have done calculations about the cost of lives, the pain and suffering that other people incurred. And I was wondering if there was any attempt to guesstimate the value of lives or people maimed or people injured, whether they're Americans or to be unnationalistic Iraqis.
Well, we've got a good and provocative question. William Nordhaus, do you have a holistic estimate of the cost of this war? Is there a way to put a cost figure on that? Does it come into an economist's view?
Yeah, you could, and it would be possible that you could say the cost of a fatality or the cost of an injury was such and such. I mean, it's as the caller just mentioned, it's exactly the kind of exercise that's going on now with the 9/11 fund. I think in this particular case, since I was looking only at the cost to the United States and quite explicitly not looking at costs to other countries, most estimates are that the casualty fatality rate is going to be pretty low. So I just left that out and did not try to monetize that. And just in terms of the other side, I just one word on that.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that really becomes apparent if you look at the Iraqi side of the equation is for the people of Iraq, it's actually hard to imagine anything that could be more disastrous and catastrophic than the kinds of lives and economies they had over the last 20 years. The decline in the Iraqi standard of living since 1980, they've had a decline of almost 90%, and I just don't know any place in the entire 20th century where you've seen that kind of catastrophic decline in living standards.
And of course, Robert Hormats, part of that has been due to these unending sanctions that the UN has put on Iraq and the U.S. has supported fiercely. Is that not couldn't that be another argument for going in and doing this? You're worried about inflation, you're worried about deficits, but we've got a recession. Deficits are a common response to recession. And we've got a situation in Iraq with a tyrant, with potentially weapons of mass destruction, with an untenable situation for Iraqis. Maybe even if this is going to be expensive, this is the time to bite the bullet and do it. I want to come back and take one more swing at that.
Well, I agree with that. I'm not arguing against the war. As a matter of fact, I think we need to go to war. I just want us to go in understanding what it's going to cost us and try to figure out how we can pay for it, what alternatives there are for meeting these additional expenses. But I do think you're right. The problem that has beset the Iraqi people, however, is not really the sanctions. That is a part of it. The sanctions were brought on by Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein and this regime have diverted huge amounts of money that could be going to the well-being of the people of Iraq and placed them into the defense budget. They have increased spending on military weaponry for as long as Saddam Hussein has been in power. They could have had these sanctions lifted at any time over the last 10 years or so. The sanctions have cost them probably $200 billion. Mm. It is Saddam Hussein and his obsessive increase in weapons spending and his defiance of the international community, which has cost the Iraqi people so dearly, as Bill's pointed out.
But it's sobering to note, as you point out, that fixing this could be very, very costly to Americans as well. Bill is on the line. Welcome, Bill. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
Sure.
Tom, good show, by the way.
Thanks.
And Professor Dr. Nordhaus and the other guests. I think you're leaving one side of the equation out in the Bush doctrine. You're leaving the profit of oil out. And I think when the United – I'm not a Bush supporter, by the way, and I think it's kind of mean-hearted. I'm kind of a liberal leftist. But looking at –
How do you see oil factoring in, Bill?
Well, I see the United States being the broker of oil into the next many decades. I see China supporting the United States and becoming the main oil user in the world.
So this is the oil dominance theory that we go to war with Iraq and end up somehow with our
Iraq
foot on
and
the
any
gas
other
pedal.
Oil country that we like to take.
Bill, thanks for the call. William Norris, let me put that to you. Do you see, I guess what's being suggested here is that deep in the White House, they may be projecting a benefit to U.S. physical control or greater control over the oil-producing region that Iraq sits on top of?
Yeah. Well, this is pure speculation. There's been no discussion of that in the public record. There are no memos that have been leaked. And actually, if you go read things like Bob Woodward's book on Bush going to mm-hmm. war, the oil really doesn't feature into the discussions at all. I think possibly that it is viewed as an ancillary benefit if everything goes well, that you might have higher oil production out of that region. But, maybe I'll be proved wrong. I just don't think that's the driving force here.
I agree with that. I think Bill makes the right point. This is not really about oil, and people who sort of construe it that way miss the fundamental point. Saddam Hussein is a tyrant. He's oppressed his people. He's building up a stash of weapons. And we know that because if he weren't, he could have gotten the sanctions lifted years ago and had $200 billion more for his people.
But Bob Hormis, let me ask you this. If the U.S. goes to war with Iraq, do you see greater oil security on the other side of that conflict for the United States?
I think that there are two ways this could break. One is, in general, I do think that there'll be more oil security because the sanctions will be lifted and there'll be more oil produced from Iraq.
But that sounds like an economic win, even if you say it's not part of the plan.
It is, but here's the basic point.
I wonder.
The Iraqis are not likely to experience a surge in oil exports. It's going to take mm-hmm. a great deal of time, 5 to 10 years, to mm-hmm. build up Iraqi oil capacity. So we can't count on a big windfall. Moreover, the money that comes out of Iraqi mm-hmm. oil, first of all, is not very much and is going to have to be used for the reconstruction of the country. And third, we're not going to be occupying that country forever. So at some point, the Iraqis will get control over that oil, not us. So this oil argument as a pretext for war is, in my judgment, a bogus one. There may be some marginal benefits. The risk, however, is if there is a war and Bill's negative scenario comes to pass, there could be disruptions in oil facilities elsewhere in the Gulf, and that would push the price of oil up for a long time. I don't think that will happen, but
it
when
could.
You go into a war, you have to keep your eyes open.
Bob Hormis, our time is winding down. Just 30 seconds left. What's the political leadership that you would like to see to come to grips realistically, honestly, with the cost of this war? What needs to be said? What needs to be done?
I think we need an open debate about the cost of the war and how we're going to pay for that war. That seems to me to be critically important. And the second thing is the state and local governments that are on the front line of the war against terrorism, they're getting hurt badly because they're seeing a collapse in revenue. They have to pay more for homeland defense. Something ought to be done to help support their homeland defense. But a credible argument, a credible debate over how to pay for this war seems to be an extremely important part of the sacrifice that Roosevelt called for. Today, Americans are going to have to make a similar sacrifice, and we should be candid about it and not duck it, and I think Americans will rise to the occasion.
It may be time. Many more questions, but we're out of time for tonight. I want to thank you, Robert Hormats, for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Robert Hormats is Vice Chairman of Goldman Sachs, and William Nordhaus, thank you so much for coming on this hour. Fascinating time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
William Nordhaus is Sterling Professor of Economics at Yale University. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Gina Cervetti, and Robin Young from Here and Now is in the studio with me. Hello, Robin.
Hi, Gina.
And Jay Clayton is here as well.
Boy, hi, Gina.
Less than 10 minutes to go, and then the fundraiser is over. But between now and then, let's see how many calls we can get.
Can I know we keep
can
it going?
I mean,
let's
many.
Go into tomorrow.
Can't come in tomorrow?
And no, because it's been so great. I mean, it's just
it really
it's
has.
Done exactly what it was supposed to do. There's several minutes left, so you can still be part of this group of thousands of listeners. That's just, I always say it wrong, step to the plate. I mix my, that's my malapropism, but you've called, and that's what we so appreciate. 1-800-909-9287, and there's still time for more.
If you can add your little bit to the $435,000 contributed so far during this fundraiser, this is it, your last chance to do it, and we'd appreciate it. 1-800-909-9287 9287 or on the web, WBUR.org. Last chance, 8 o'clock, we wrap up the fundraiser. So give us a call.
An entire hour of On Point And it's fundraiser-free. Fundraiser-free from here on out, really, from 8 o'clock, of course, because it all ends at 8 o'clock. 7 minutes to go. Let's make those minutes filled with phone calls, 1-800-909-9287.
You can join listeners like Leslie Ballard and Gwen Krause and Loring Palmer. I love that name, Loring Palmer. Let's see, Pamela Lord, Dana Gravelin, Ruth Humphreys, Bill Piggott and Rick Brigham. Both of them were first-time contributors, and they really stepped to the plate.
Well, welcome.
Welcome, and thank you so much because you went above and beyond in your contributions. We really appreciate it. There's time to join these great listeners, 1-800-909-9287.
No invitation needed. Just give us a call. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call. $440,000 the tally, and continuing to rise. Thank you so very much if you've called. If not, take the time to do it now. If you generally write some generous contributions, whatever the amount happens to be, to the organizations that are meaningful to your life, at this time of year, take this last chance now during the on-air fundraiser to contribute to WBUR. Do it on the web or do it on the phone, WBUR.org or 1-800-909-9287.
And I want to also thank Andrew in Concord for calling up, Anne in Melrose, thank you very much, Elaine in Hollis, and Stanley in Wellesley. Thank you very much to all of you who called up. We appreciate it, and of course, thank you to those that we didn't name on the air.
Oh, let's do that. Let's name all of them.
Well, then
the fundraiser will continue past 8 o'clock.
That's right.
We'll also thank Maggiano's for bringing the food in for the staff and volunteers tonight. Thank you all very, very much.
And thank you to the volunteers as well. It's been terrific. And, you know, thank you to you, the listeners. And if you've been listening in the last half hour closely, then you heard what it's all about. It's not about your politics. It's about your interest in the truth and objective reporting. We just heard this terrific interview that Tom conducted, as usual. It was terrific. And, you know, talking about the cost of possible war with Iraq and the possibility, but also why there might be a war with Iraq. And they really kind of shot down arguments from people who might think that this is because of one political side or another. It's not about that. It's about finding out the truth, in that case, the truth of the cost of such an endeavor. And if that's what you're interested in, then you're in the right place, and we need to just go to another little place, which is closer to your phone, 1-800-909-9287.
It's interactive radio. You call on the phone, give some money, and great stuff comes out of the radio. Important stuff to hear. 1-800-909-9287. The last 5 minutes. Hard to believe, but it's here. The last 5 minutes of the year-end fundraiser for WBUR. Make the most of it if you haven't contributed yet by taking a couple of those 5 minutes and making your contribution, a generous one of whatever amount is right for you, $5 or $10 a month, $60 or $120 for the year. 1-800-909-9287.
It's really getting down to the wire. We've got less than 4 minutes to go now until 8 o'clock. Let's see how many times we can make those phone rings between now and then.
Here's an incentive. You can get a great fleece jacket for a donation of $365. Or if you mention that you have children, we will put their name into a hopper, and just their name into a hopper, and then we're going to pull the names out, and we'll have a kiddie radio party down the road. Those are some incentives. I just want to mention, am I seeing Bob Oakes through that glass window? What, does he live here?
I'm seeing Bob Oakes.
I can't believe it. He's the guy who started this all a few days ago and probably came in just to see, to celebrate. Come on in, Bob.
He's here to help us wrap it up.
It's like, do you live here?
Hey,
Oaks. Isn't it 8 a.m.?
No.
Oh, I'm going home.
You've got 12 hours left, man.
Go home, because he did such a terrific job on his shift on Morning Edition, and this is another example of how many hours people put in.
Absolutely.
For you. 1-800-909-9287.
Or WBUR.org on the web. Thank you so very much if you've contributed. It's really remarkable the amount of support that has been put forward for WBUR. We're very, very gratified by that. And it's $440,000+ contributed during this fundraiser. If you're part of that, thank you very much for doing that. Thanks to all the volunteers, all the bakeries and restaurants that brought in food to keep the volunteers fed, to help out with the phone answering, and the WBUR staff as well for helping with that. 1-800-909-